Welcome to the Sonic Imperfections podcast. That was Transference 3 by Thomas Stone, who is playing at the next Sonic Imperfections on Tuesday the 9th of June. So welcome once again to the Sonic Imperfections podcast. My name's Ian Farragher. I'm joined tonight by Nigel Bryant.
Hello again.
And Peter Challis.
Hello.
Later in the show, we'll have a live session from Darkroom and chat to them about their new album. But first, this. Thank you. That was the continuing story of Counterpoint, Part 9, by David Borden from the album Music for Keyboard Instruments, released 2014 on Spectrum Spools. That track's written in 1980, and it's a track, one part of a 12-part piece written between 1976 and 87 by David Borden. And to me, David Borden's one of the great lost minimalists. You know, he's contemporary of Steve Reich and Terry Riley. And in fact, the three people playing on that, David Borden, Paul Epstein and Neurit Tiles, who I know Neurit from her work with Steve Reich. She's on all his early recordings and everything. So can't figure why David Borden isn't better known than he is. Maybe this CD that came out a couple of years ago, or no, 2014, will broaden his people's awareness of him. It's a fantastic record. And he was also a close colleague of Bob Moog in the really early days of the Bob Moog's were, and Bob Moog actually called him his chief idiot because he would give him the modular parts of the modular synths, and David Borden would go away and connect them up in all these crazy ways, thinking that that's how they worked, and it definitely wasn't how they worked. And he'd take them back to Mr. Moog all burnt out, and he'd go, really, you actually thought you could connect them like that? Okay, I best change my designs. And apparently it went to and from, and then eventually, after this backwards and forwards a while, they got a good working synthesizer. So he's influential in that way as well.
Yeah, well, the first thing I thought when I heard that was, it sounded like an 80s Terry Riley, and I mean that in a good way. You know, it's a lovely piece of music. But I think the interesting thing is the fact that even though the sequencer technology would have been available at the time to play those complex arpeggios, it was actually all played live. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, David Broden, Paul Epstein and Neurit Tiles. So as I mentioned earlier, we're lucky enough to have Darkroom in the studio with us tonight, who are going to play live right now. So please take it away, boys.
Thank you.
Absolutely splendid. Wonderful track there from Darkroom. And as we officially welcome them into the studio now, Darkroom, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
So that track you've just played, what was that? Does it have a title? Can you tell us anything about it?
Let's call it Never the Same Way Once.
Excellent. Could you describe what we were hearing then?
Well, instrument-wise, the lineup you have there is Mike's guitar and many pedals. You have my bass clarinet and much processing thereof, and you also have my my modular synth here doing little synthy noises, and all of that comes together in my laptop with a bunch of effects and looping and such like. So everything you heard there was one of those elements played, not programmed in any way, just played as we felt it.
No, I think that's key. It's played, and so at the heart of that piece, which is very relaxed and ambient to suit the atmosphere that we're in, there's a kind of conversation between the two instruments. There's a kind of improvised dialogue going on in some setting that's created. And typically what happens when we play live as Darkroom, we might have sketched out something that looks half like an arrangement, but not really. But the laptop starts off empty. There's no sound in there. There's no bunch of pre-programmed samples. Any samples that are generated are taken directly from either me playing the guitar or Oz is sampling live as he's playing the clarinet, and they get spun in and processed in different forms. Out of that, some kind of background is created, and then we are interacting with that and with each other. So it's very much played. There's nothing in there to start with. So we had, in fact, no idea what was going to happen when that kicked off.
So, for instance, with your guitar, you say you've got a bunch of, and we can see the bunch of effects you've got. So is your guitar going in dry to the computer, or is it the affected signal goes in?
Oz is getting whatever I've processed through there. So he's got no direct version of the guitar to do something with later. And that's kind of deliberate. I'm actually interacting with the sound I'm making directly, and we don't store the live guitar in some separate form to do anything else with later.
No.
I mean, key to that sound is a kind of auto-wah treatment that I love, fed into big echo, and I like that, to the sound of that kind of wah almost degrading and rippling and oscillating a bit.
So what effects do you particularly like using, Mike?
On the pedal board, I've got a switching system set up that lets me route between a couple of different things. It's actually not that complicated. What I like to do is have a choice of different distortion tones. I like distortion from the amp, although typically we use the amp DI'd, a fuzz and an overdrive, and I've gone through various ones of those over the years. I like phaser for that authentic 70s swirly vibe. And the auto-wah probably comes from listening to far too much electric Miles Davis, I think. It's that kind of sound.
Can you listen to too much?
Well, that's a point for discussion. Maybe you should do a write-in on that.
Wasn't Miles very fond of using a ring modulator on his trumpet as well?
Yeah, so in fact the Eventide delay I've got has a ring mod setting, and one of the tracks that you're going to feature, or a track from the album, which you're going to feature a bit of later, I think we've used that to full effect. Okay. So I love it. I love authentic ring mod, although challenging to play in any kind of band context.
And then the guitar signal goes into the modular computer type stuff.
Yes.
What happens then?
It all comes into the computer. So basically what I've got set up in the computer is a way of capturing what Mike is doing at any one time and then dragging that audio clip into a number of kind of pre-prepared mixer tracks, basically, where I can layer up lots of different samples of Michael going at the same time. I've got the laptop is also processing my clarinet, so I've got a few effects, some four simultaneous looping delays set up just for the clarinet. And then I've got four more loopers set up that I can throw anything else that's currently going on into. I've got another whole section of the laptop set up, which is for controlling the modular.
Yeah. And how are you controlling those separate parts? You have a piece of hardware that you...
Largely it is with a mouse, actually. I do have a MIDI fader box kind of on the side, which does the basic stuff, just like track levels, so I can fade tracks up and down easily, and some knobs for direct control of the more commonly changed parameters. But there's so much stuff going on, I could never map it all to a control surface, really. I end up honestly looking like I'm checking my email, I'm sure, for most of the gig, which is one reason I love bringing the clarinet or something out, is because it's very obvious to people at that point that I am actually a musician of a sort.
And is that your musical education then, the clarinet?
Yeah, I played clarinet, regular clarinet at school, in a kind of the school wind band. Not awesomely well, has to be said. So yeah, but that's where my muscle memory still is, in terms of going back to it. So yeah, about 2 years ago now, I really decided to start playing it in earnest and got a teacher and started putting in some proper practicing and stuff.
So you mentioned you've got a new album coming out. Let's listen to a track from that. Wow. What can you tell us about that track?
Probably the first thing is it wasn't even meant to happen. Perhaps if I explain a little bit, the album's a collection of recordings from the Choosies Post concert series that Oz and I have run with Georgina Brett over the last year. And that was the end of our set for the night. And probably we both thought we'd finished sometime before there, but started building up. We started adding to it, and I thought, well, perhaps we can just add a bit more to it, and a little bit more. And as is the way with these massive drones, if you set them up, and sometimes they build up their own momentum. I won't say we were aiming for that, but we just went with it. And perhaps one of the things I should say about Oz is we've known each other for quite a long time, so I completely trust him. Therefore, if I do something strange, he will often respond in a way that makes it sound like I knew what I was doing. And the reverse is sometimes also true. If he throws a curveball at me, I'll respond to it. And we've evolved a kind of a natural way of doing that. So that it made sense at the time. When I listened to it back declipped, I thought, oh, actually, there was something... There's something else in there that I want to hear. I mean, I listen to that and it reminds me of part of the 2001 A Space Odyssey soundtrack, the Ligeti atmospheres. I mean, that wasn't what I was thinking at the time, but I listened to it and think, oh yeah, I'm glad I captured some of that in something that we were doing, because it was a huge influence along with so many things. But yeah.
And you talk about the level of volume during that performance. Is volume something that's really important to you as in a live context? Do you like to have that loudness?
What I really like is dynamics. So I guess that implies we can go loud, but that also implies that we cover a sonic spectrum. We can go, you know, several octaves lower than the guitar can, either warm and soft or really percussive and driving. Dynamics, clarity, being, you know, it's great to have the option to go loud, but it's great to have the option to contrast that then with something that's much, much, much quieter. Mm. And to do it in a venue where people are listening, so that you've really got that space.
So is this a live album then?
Yes and no. What we've done is taken the live performances. The title of the album is The Rest Is Noise, and that implies that we made some choice about what we left in, because we think if we're going to make it available for download, then we'd like it to be out there in a form that someone might want to listen to more than once.
That said, it's 3¾ hours long. So yeah. We left quite a lot in, it has to be said.
Sadly, what we didn't do is keep a diff file of everything that we took out so we could then release that as a bonus track. Just the noise.
Just the noise.
I think that conceptually that appeals to me in a number of ways that probably it shouldn't.
And your previous album, was the process radically different then to the process for this album?
Oh, interesting. So the main album that we released almost a couple of years ago now is a thing called Gravity's Dirty Work. It starts off as the same process, but probably we're not expecting to produce a finished track at the end, although that could happen.
I think if you're going to contrast Gravity's Dirty Work to The Rest Is Noise, yes, it all started with improvisation, but it was studio improvisation. It was sitting down in a room saying, right, let's record five passes of guitar in this key around this kind of idea and see where that goes. So none of the tracks were in any sense actually played live. From that sense, the new one is definitely a live album.
Yeah, the pieces are pretty much as they were created, but they've been silently fixed up so that the bits that we shouldn't have played, those are gone.
Well, should we have another track from the album? What do you want to play us now?
Bit tricky to choose from a 3¾-hour long album. Tonight when we were here, we played something very, very ambient. We've played Wall of Noise. Is this going to be Wall of Beat? This is Pitch Drop Experiment with apologies to Vangelis. Thank you.
Well, that was vastly different. That wasn't ambient, that wasn't noisy at all. That was more like acid house track or something.
Yeah, this is what happens when basically I get carried away with my my synthesizer and
stop listening
listening in some ways. Yes, that's fair. So yeah, I mean, we've talked about how this album is a live album but edited for listenability. That was one of the more drastic edits we made over the whole album, is that most of that section actually has Mike's guitar part completely removed. Any guitar was from where I'd looped the guitar in the laptop, so there's all kinds of guitar heroics going on over the top of that which you don't hear, to kind of strip it back to what became the essence of that track, which was this big synthy beaty workout.
Yeah, I think I probably on reflection what I should have done is sat out that one anyway, but listening back to the way we've got it processed for the live album, I like the kind of echoes of guitar that come in. They're sampled from something. I don't think you need to hear what they're sampled from. I couldn't have generated those without playing it live, but actually for something I want to listen to, I don't want to hear the main guitar track anymore. One of the things I really like about working with Oz is he doesn't have any conventional constraints about sound sources. So, for example, on previous albums we've recorded drummers, but Oz will be quite happy to process a drum kit off in true 60s stereo side, so it's all panned on the left. There's no kind of bass drum has to be in the middle, snare drum has to sound like this. Just pan it all off to one side. It's just another sound source. It's a living sample library. And that I find really frees us up. We're not constrained by what things should sound like. So I don't feel particularly constrained by what guitars should sound like. I use an electric guitar, gone to places occasionally and taken one out of the case, and you almost see people go, oh no, it's an electric guitar. Oh no, it's going to sound like X, whatever X is. You know,
who are these people that don't like electric guitars?
No, and perhaps in a free improvisation context, people have some idea about what they think is going to happen, or they expect that someone is going to come along and do something that doesn't fit in that context, rather than just enjoy the sound of the instrument and almost strip it back to the sound and do things with that. So even though I've spent quite a bit of time now playing guitar, I'm very happy to pretend that I can't, or just, you know, try and recapture that what did it first sound like feeling. That's something I very much want to get into our music, and why I like working with Oz is because he's very happy to indulge that, but also with other sound sources. You know, we could have a snare drum panned hard left, we can have something that goes through 50 seconds of reverb. Pretty hard to fit that into a 3-minute piece.
Indeed.
One of the things I decided we should try on this piece is I wanted to involve one of the people who introduced me to improvised music, is bassist Simon Fell. Simon's now based somewhere in the middle of France, and I asked him if he could record some double bass, and we had some discussion about whether he would come over to the UK to do it. In the end, he said, I'll do it for my living room. Two microphones, I'll just set them up and do what I think you want. And he gave us some beautifully recorded bass to choose from. It wasn't what I've sometimes seen Simon do, which is full-on noise assault. In fact, it was incredibly restrained and beautiful and poised and just what the track needed.
And then together with Simon Taylor's trumpet, who's another improviser we've been lucky to work with in the past, we decided the track needed some trumpet. I forget who decided that, but again, we set up a recording session. Mike went into a rehearsal room with a pocket WAV recorder and pointed it at a trumpet. And
yeah, I think I set Simon up with the track on my iPod and just said, I think what I really wanted him to do was deliver something that sounded like a cross between Miles Davis and the Coronation Street theme trumpet. And I was so fixed on that that for about half an hour I couldn't see that what he was producing was just beautiful. And in the end, when I gave up on the original idea, because we couldn't sync it to the track, he was just listening to my iPod, something came out and I thought, well, we've got mute, we've got straight trumpet, I'm sure we've got something in here. And after about two evenings we came up with the trumpet line as it is. So it's almost like with the Aardman animations of improvisation in that context. It's stop motion, take a little section, piece it, but it's all come from something improvised. And in the end, what we've assembled together with Andy Booker on the drums is it's our version of a jazz quintet.
A great track there from a great album. That's A Pair Apart from the Gravity's Dirty Work album. Doesn't really sound like the rest of the album, though.
Yeah, it went in an unexpected direction. It starts very much like all the other tracks with a big, long, kind of looping guitar introduction. It actually ends quite like a typical Darkroom track in a kind of abstract coda of loop and texture. It's just in the middle, it goes somewhere a little bit unusual. But I mean, maybe this is a thing we do. The album before that, we had a kind of a dub reggae track in the middle of, with a Shadows guitar solo on. So it's just a wild card.
So back to the new album, The Rest Is Noise. Is it, or when's it released?
It's just out.
And it's available from?
From darkroomtheband.bandcamp.com.
And at 3 hours long, I suspect it's not a physical release.
Oh, if only. So Gravity's Dirty Work is on double vinyl. That was an indulgence. Looks and sounds fantastic. If this were to be on vinyl, I think we calculated it would be 6 discs. It would ruin us.
Not even Yes did that.
Not even Yes. So, I mean, in some ways, we're potentially upstage, because I think Tom York's just released some 18-day track, or there's a rumour that he has an 18-day track on. So we were thinking 4 hours, that's a bit indulgent.
Yeah.
But not really.
Compared to that, it's a snappy single.
But really, this is just part one of many, because this only takes us up to October of last year, and we've been gigging at least once a month since then and recording it every time. So.
And speaking of gigging, when can we see you again?
You can see us very soon, Sunday the 14th of June, at the Peck and Pelican Listening Club.
Well, thank you very much, Michael Bearpark. Andrew Osler, Darkroom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was March of the Shadows by Black Tempest. Black Tempest is Stephen Bradbury, who is usually makes very lovely sort of cosmic synth type records, but he's discovered his inner riff on this new album. And the album is called Darkness Unfolding, and it's available with the latest issue of the Optical Sounds fanzine, which I think sadly has sold out. But maybe go to Black Tempest Bandcamp page and send Stephen a message, and maybe he'll have some spare copies of that album.
Did you say where he's from?
He is from the UK. He is from, I think it's Surrey.
Oh, okay. Well, coming to the end of the podcast now, it just leaves it to me to give you two very important dates. On the 9th of June, we have Sonic Imperfections at the Montague Arms. We have musical legend Steve Beresford opening the show with Elaine Michener on vocals. We then have Thomas Stone, who you heard at the top of the show. And then from Berlin, we have a group called Slow Slow Loris, which is Angie Nina and Robert Heim. And they're from coming over from Berlin, so we're very excited about that. And then the next Sonic Imperfections on the 14th of July, we have Finglebone, Adam Bowman and Martin Pine. So it just leaves it to me to say thank you to Peter Chalice.
Thank you.
Nigel Bryant.
Thank you very much.
And this is Slow Slow Loris.
So bad.